Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Ukrainian soldiers raise the national flag in Slavonsk, and a suicide car bombing has killed at least five people in Somalia. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Ukrainian troops have overtaken the pro-Russian rebel stronghold of Slavonsk in the country's east. President Petro Poroshenko ordered the Ukrainian flag raised over the city after the nighttime offensive. Officials and some witnesses say that rebels evacuated the city after coming under mortar fire from government forces. The government's retaking of the city marks a rare victory in Ukraine's struggle to quell the months-long rebellion. The Palestinian Attorney General says an autopsy on the Arab teenager killed in a suspected revenge attack shows he was burned to death. The body of Mohammed Abu Kuder was found in a Jerusalem forest Wednesday, about an hour after he was forced into a car by kidnappers. Palestinian forensics officials report finding smoke in his respiratory canals, meaning Kuder was breathing while he was being burned. The Attorney General said Saturday Kuder had burns over 90% of his body. Israeli police say they're investigating whether the killing was retaliation for the kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teens found burned earlier this week.
Muhammad Badi Abdel Majid, Muhammad Ibrahim Beltagi.
An Egyptian court has sentenced Muslim Brotherhood leader Muhammad Badi and 36 other Islamists to life in prison. Badi, who was convicted of involvement in last year's deadly protest, had already received death sentences in two other cases. The presiding judge said today defendants were involved in violence and murder during protests last July after the army ousted President Mohamed Morsi, who also belonged to the Brotherhood. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says he will never give up the fight for a third term in office in spite of growing pressure for him to step down. In a statement on state television Friday, Mr. Maliki vowed to remain in office until Islamic militants who've overrun large areas of the country are defeated. His alliance of Shiite parties won parliamentary elections in May. International and human rights groups are demanding Pakistan discard its new anti-terrorism law, condemning it as a blatant attack on the fundamental rights of the people. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
The National Parliament approved the so-called Protection of Pakistan Act this week, giving sweeping powers to security forces targeting violent extremism and terrorism. The legislation gives police officers sweeping powers to open fire on suspects and also allows anyone detained for questioning to be held for up to 60 days before charges must be brought. The legislation has outraged human rights defenders in and outside the country. In a statement Friday, the Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan said the government is deliberately following the model of a police state. Ayaz Ghul, Islamabad.
Somali police say a suicide car bombing outside the country's parliament has killed at least five people, including two soldiers guarding the building. The al-Qaeda-linked militant group al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for today's blast in Mogadishu and says such attacks will continue. A car loaded with explosives blew up when it was stopped by soldiers at a checkpoint before entering the entrance to parliament. Parliament was in session at the time of the blast. About a dozen people were wounded. A strike by more than 200,000 engineers and metalworkers is dealing another blow to South Africa's economy. Gillian Parker reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
The industrial action was called by the National Union of Metalworkers of South Africa, or NUMSA, the country's largest union. NUMSA is demanding a 12% pay raise and better housing allowances for workers. This latest strike affects around 10,500 companies, including steel producers, foundries, construction companies and automotive suppliers. Police fired rubber bullets Thursday at workers who were blocking an entrance to the Eskom Madupi power station construction site. There were local radio reports of striking workers assaulting people and looting offices in Johannesburg. NUMSA has denied the allegations. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And in World Cup, it heats up again with the last two games of the quarterfinals. Argentina battles the young Belgian team in Brasilia, and the Netherlands takes on the surprise of the tournament, Costa Rica in Salvador. Meantime, President Barack Obama talked about the American team in his address today.
We are so proud of you. You've got a lot of new believers. And I know there's actually a petition on the White House website to make Tim Howard the next Secretary of Defense.
The president said that's not likely to happen anytime soon, as Chuck Hagel is handling the position ably. On Friday, Germany beat rival France in Rio de Janeiro and will continue to seek its fourth World Cup championship, with Brazil also beating Colombia. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's Saturday, July 5th. Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga.
The judge read his verdict aloud slowly amid intermittent heckling by the defendants. He sentenced 10 men to die and ordered 37 others to spend the rest of their lives in prison.
An Egyptian court sentences 10 defendants to death and 37 others to life imprisonment.
The World Health Organization says more intense engagement with local communities is needed to stop the increasingly deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Strategies for containing the outbreak were discussed this week in Ghana's capital, Accra, where health ministers from 11 African nations met with the WHO and partner organizations.
West African governments and international organizations discuss how to stop the increasingly deadly Ebola outbreak in the region.
The International Tobacco Growers Association says it will fight moves by the World Health Organization in some African nations to discourage smoking, saying the campaign has some economic consequences.
And we look at balancing the risks of tobacco smoking with the economic interests of tobacco growers. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. An Egyptian court has handed down death sentences to 10 defendants and ordered life imprisonment for 37 others, including three top leaders of the now outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Defense lawyers are appealing the court's ruling. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The judge read his verdict aloud slowly amid intermittent heckling by the defendants. He sentenced 10 men to die and ordered 37 others to spend the rest of their lives in prison. The three top Muslim Brotherhood leaders sentenced to life include the group's supreme guide and spiritual leader, Mohammed Badia. Members of the audience, attorneys for the defense, and many of the defendants themselves tried to shout down the judge at several points before eventually falling silent. The verdict by the court in Cairo's Shubra district will now be appealed to a higher court. The case involves violence in a province north of Cairo during protests last July against the ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. Several people were killed and wounded, and vehicles were torched in the clashes. Presiding Judge Hassan Farid blamed the defendants for the violence and said they had acted out of terrorist motives. The Muslim Brotherhood itself was banned earlier this year after the government declared it was a terrorist group. On its Arabic website, Ikhwan Online, the Brotherhood condemned the verdicts and said 10 innocent people were condemned to death. Political sociologist Saeed Sadiq notes the verdict came at the same time as a government decision to raise fuel prices, a development that drew public attention away from the case. Sadiq said this was not the first trial conducted in a similar manner, and he told VOA most Egyptians are now used to such verdicts. The political analyst contends that Western criticism of such trials is misplaced, especially since many Western states themselves have resorted to strenuous measures when confronted by what they see as domestic terrorism.
It is just surprising how the West has double standards when it comes to terrorism. When they get hit by terrorists, they are ready to take action and even extra legal action. And when Egypt does the same to save itself from the fate of its neighboring failed states like Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Syria, you have this criticism about the Egyptian judicial system.
A number of Egyptian trials during the past year, including one in which a judge delivered a sweeping verdict ordering the death penalty for hundreds of defendants, have created an uproar in the West. Executions appear to have been delayed indefinitely, however, and it is unclear whether the sentences will actually be carried out. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
In Somalia, officials say a suicide car bombing near parliament has killed at least three police officers and wounded several others. Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab rebels have claimed responsibility for the blast Saturday in the capital of Mogadishu and say such attacks will continue. Parliament was in session at the time of the blast. Officials say the car loaded with explosives blew up when it was stopped by soldiers at a checkpoint before reaching the entrance to parliament. Al-Shabaab has continued to carry out attacks, including a May assault on parliament that killed 18 people. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says more intense engagement with the local communities is needed to stop the increasingly deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Strategies for containing the outbreak were discussed this week in Ghana's capital, Accra, where health ministers from 11 nations met with the WHO and partner organizations. Jennifer Lazuta has more from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
High-level health officials from 11 African countries say they have agreed on strategies for stopping the spread of the Ebola virus as quickly as possible. The World Health Organization, WHO, says there have been at least 759 Ebola cases and that 467 people have died across Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone since the outbreak began in February. Despite response efforts by local and international teams, the number of cases and deaths continue to rise on an almost daily basis. Pierre Formenti, an Ebola specialist with the WHO, outlined the three main priorities that health officials agreed on.
The first is to engage more in depth and more intense manner with the community and to have them at the center and the pillar of the communication and also the surveillance and the control of the Ebola outbreak. Second, we are going also to intensify our surveillance system, detecting cases of Ebola, and also intensive follow-up of contact with the primary objective to stop the chain of transmission.
Formenti said the third priority is to increase the capacity of treatment centers and improve the quality of treatment, while ensuring families that health workers are doing everything they can to reduce the high mortality rate. Because there is no way to prevent or cure Ebola, the only way to stop the spread of the virus is to isolate those that fall sick and prevent them from infecting others. Health officials say that a number of factors have made it difficult, however, to stop this outbreak, including the highly mobile nature of people in the region and the continuation of traditional burial practices in which people touch the body of the dead. Many communities, particularly in rural areas, remain highly suspicious of foreign doctors and nurses. Some hide out when sick. Others even deny the existence of Ebola. Formenti said that better community cooperation is needed to bring the outbreak to an end.
We need all and everybody to stop an outbreak of Ebola. It's with the population and with the family and with the affected population that we'll be able to control this outbreak. The medical team alone cannot stop Ebola. We really need to work together.
Formenti said that in addition to implementing these strategies in the infected countries, health ministries from other West African countries will prepare action plans in case the disease spreads to other countries. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is producing better quality information on its revenues from natural resources. That's according to EITI, an organization aimed at improving the governance of mineral and oil wealth. For VOA, Nick Long reports.
The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, or EITI, is a coalition of 45 governments plus companies and civil society groups. It focuses on exposing tax evasion and lost revenues associated with natural resources. The DRC was suspended from the EITI last year as the organization's board determined that Congo's reporting was insufficient. In particular, the board wanted independent audits of mining companies and tax agencies and monitoring of revenue and spending from a $6.3 billion venture between Congo's state mining company and a Chinese consortium. On Wednesday, the board decided that the DRC has addressed these issues and agreed to recognize the country as a full EITI member. The head of the EITI Secretariat, Jonas Moberg, praised what he called an extraordinary level of engagement in the EITI process in DRC. He added that although the country's natural resources are not managed perfectly, there is now a process to ensure a well-informed debate. Badi Baldi, manager for Central Africa at the EITI Secretariat in Norway, tells VOA that the DRC's latest report for 2011 is much better than the one for 2010.
So for 2011, what you can see is about $1.4 billion that was paid to the government at various levels. There is detailed accounting for this, who has collected the revenues from who, and where did they send the money to. Learning the lessons from the 2010 report, there is now very thorough work that has been done.
The group Global Witness, which campaigns for more transparency and accountability in natural resource management, agrees the DRC has made progress. Nathaniel Dyer is a Global Witness researcher.
Global Witness thinks that there have been great strides forward with EITI in Congo. EITI has put a lot of new information into the public realm, saying that we still have some pretty major concerns about the governance of Congo's mineral and oil wealth. Transparency doesn't necessarily lead to accountability or lead to the lack of bad practices.
Dyer points to the sales of five of Congo's biggest mining concessions by state mining company Gécamines in recent years. Another research group, the Africa Progress Panel, says those assets were undervalued and the sales resulted in a loss to the Congolese state and people of at least $1.35 billion in potential revenue.
Gécamines, the Congolese state mining company, they have been at the heart of these secret sales of mining assets. They don't provide audited annual reports, and there's a danger that they are acting like a black hole in the middle of Congo's mining sector.
EITI's Balde says that EITI's main focus so far has been on tracing what companies actually pay rather than what they might pay. But he says that going forward, EITI will be focusing on the accountability of state-owned enterprises like Gécamines and will be trying to find out who are the real owners of the concessions the company sold. He adds that EITI will also be investigating collection of revenue from small-scale mining in eastern Congo. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
The International Tobacco Growers Association says it will fight moves by the World Health Organization and some African nations to discourage smoking, saying the campaign has economic consequences. For VOA, Sebastian Mhofu reports from Harare, where the association has been meeting with African tobacco farmers.
After a three-day meeting in Harare, the president of the International Tobacco Growers Association, Francis Van de Meve, told VOA that the anti-tobacco campaign would result in the economy of some African countries crashing as they depend heavily on the leaf.
The anti-tobacco lobby is a very vocal, a very extreme, and a very out-of-touch lobby. They have one thing in mind, and that is to damage the tobacco industry. The best thing for them to do is to start working with the tobacco industry so that they can understand the tobacco industry. By extreme measures, we will damage the industry, which makes huge contributions to economies all around the world.
In Zimbabwe, tobacco is overwhelmingly the main cash crop. This year, it expects to export more than $600 million worth of tobacco, mainly to China. The World Food Programme says that farmers' reliance on tobacco has contributed to the country's food shortages. Farmers shun staple crops such as maize and favour tobacco, which they call golden leaf, despite the hazards of smoking and the calls for anti-smoking campaigns by the WHO. That explains why Norman Chaganetsa, a tobacco farmer and a government official, is totally against the idea of a strong anti-smoking campaign. I asked him what would happen to Zimbabwe if demand for tobacco significantly dropped.
Tobacco is very important for the economy, and we earn a lot of money from tobacco. If it falls, and we need perhaps something to take that last slack that will have been created by that fall. So it will actually affect the revenue of the fiscus, the livelihoods of people, and the standard of living. We will have a difficult economic times.
The International Tobacco Growers Association says that a total of 24 million Africans across 15 countries depend on the tobacco industry for their livelihood. It is for this reason that the association says it will make its voice heard at an upcoming international conference on tobacco control taking place this October in Moscow. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Meanwhile, the Uganda Parliament is considering a new tobacco control bill that would put strict limits on tobacco marketing and consumption. The measure is popular with health professionals, but the tobacco industry is up in arms, with small-scale tobacco farmers saying the bill will drive them out of business. Hilary Hula has more for VOA from Kampala.
In Ahmed Mugisa's drying shed outside Kikoboza, in the lush fields of western Uganda, rows of brown, crinkled tobacco leaves whisper and rustle as he makes room for a fresh crop. Mugisa has been growing tobacco for 7 years, ever since his student days. Thanks to tobacco, he says, he paid for his own education, married a wife, bought a motorbike and a cow, and now sends his two children to school. He also grows cabbage, but he says tobacco is his best crop because it enjoys a ready market and a stable price. This, he says, lets farmers like him plan for the future. But for Ugandan tobacco farmers, the future is less certain than they thought. The tobacco control bill currently before Parliament proposes strict limits on marketing and consumption, banning smoking in and around public buildings. It also prohibits advertising tobacco products or even displaying cigarettes in shops. Several neighboring countries have similar laws. MP Chris Baryomunsi, the author of the bill, says these measures are in no way extreme.
The bill is not intended to ban the growing of tobacco. The bill does not ban smoking. The bill does not curtail the operations of the tobacco industry, but rather it's put in place a framework for regulation.
But the tobacco industry is up in arms. Among those protesting in front of Parliament are small-scale farmers who argue that the bill would destroy their livelihoods. Baryomunsi says it's big tobacco companies who are behind the protests.
The tobacco industry, whenever this kind of piece of legislation is initiated, they usually fight back to undermine the process. And one way they do it is to incite the farmers and give them misleading information for the farmers to think that the bill is against them. And this is what has happened in Uganda.
But Fred Asaba, a tobacco farmer who works with Mugisa, insists their concerns are real. If the bill passes, he argues, it will decrease demand for tobacco, which will drive down the price of the raw leaves. At the end of the day, he says, it's the small farmers who will suffer. But although it's a popular crop in his area, Moses Biencha of the Hoima District Farmers Association takes a different view of tobacco.
Actually, it's not good. It's labor intensive. It takes actually 90% of your time, which means that you will have problems with food for home consumption. And even worst of all, after selling tobacco, you go to start buying food using the money that you have from tobacco. You have to go and buy from those people who grow food.
Many farmers, he says, are lured into growing tobacco by the incentives offered by companies, including agricultural inputs and high interest loans. If the bill passes, he says, it might encourage farmers to look for alternatives that would ultimately benefit them more. Even Mugisa knows there's a dark side to his bright-leafed crop. The drying leaves make him cough, he says, enough so that he won't let his children near the tobacco. He also knows that smoking can eventually kill. But if it becomes impossible to sell his crinkled brown leaves, he adds, the government should find another cash crop to take its place. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kikoboza.
Efforts by the United Nations and many others to prevent a political crisis within South Sudan's leadership from taking a violent turn have failed. That's what Hilde Johnson, the head of the UN mission in South Sudan, said as her 3-year term in office comes to an end. Government forces have been battling rebels loyal to the former vice president, Riek Machar, since December of last year. The special envoy said she felt the country's leaders needed to take collective responsibility for what happened and stop pointing fingers at each other. Ms. Johnson shared with UN Radio's Elizabeth Philp the lessons learned about managing crises.
What went wrong was that a political crisis within the leadership was not resolved. I think all of them need to take collective responsibility for what happened and stop pointing fingers at each other. And unfortunately, this took a violent turn, and even worse, it resorted to ethnic killings. That went wrong, but of course, we should have seen this avoided. Many efforts were made, including my own, but also many, many others. They didn't succeed, and unfortunately, the population of South Sudan and the country is now suffering the worst crisis in its history.
The mission had faced difficulties in its relationship with the government. Are there any lessons learned from this experience that might be useful for the UN and other countries?
I think the lessons we can learn is more about how you manage those tensions and how you retain your impartiality and not let yourself be intimidated or pressured in any way. That is the lesson you can learn from it. I think it's difficult to avoid and prevent these things from happening, although we can always hope that wisdom will prevail also in these situations. But I think the critical thing is that the United Nations need to stand by any special representative that is facing a situation like this. The Security Council, the same. The top leadership, the same. And it has to be a very strong message that we will not allow the United Nations to be pressured or intimidated in any way. And I felt I had that support here from New York. And I really want to appreciate also the way the Secretary General personally has been supportive, also coming to South Sudan on the 6th of May and made a big difference.
You've had a long relationship with Africa. What does your time as the UN envoy to South Sudan mean to you in that context?
Well, it's meant a lot, and I really have a very strong attachment to Sudan and South Sudan from way back, through the negotiations on the CPA and prior to that, and also the South Sudanese population as such, who have suffered more than almost any others that I know and who really didn't deserve to see their worst nightmares come again and haunt them. And so I will still keep my heart with them and with the region. I am born in East Africa. I will never leave East Africa. And in South Sudan and in Sudan, they usually say the following: if you have been drinking the waters of the Nile, you'll always return. And so I will do that in one way or the other. But of course, I will continue to work on issues related to the continent. That's for sure.
What advice would you have for your successor?
Well, I think the primary person to advise my successor would be the Secretary General himself and his team. And I would be careful at providing advice myself. I think the main thing is to really come to the country with an open mind. And I think beyond that, it's very important to stand on one's own two feet and make sure that you listen, you learn, but you're also firm in how to run the mission. And I think any other advice beyond what I hope to see, which is a tough person, I will leave to the Secretary General and his team.
What are you proudest of as a female special representative of the Secretary General, of whom there are few?
I think it's very important to be a woman in one of the larger peacekeeping operations, which includes also a significant military component, and show that we are able to take on those challenges on an equal footing as men and prove that we can. But
that was Hilde Jensen, the head of the UN mission in South Sudan. She spoke with UN Radio's Elizabeth Philp. This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the program, we shall have our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent, and then have our weekend commentary. But this is Saturday, and let's start off with a Saturday music spot. So just sit back, relax, and enjoy this African music.
Maître ya maîtrise paya aspect Pichu Loboko Vincent Gomez Hugues Golondele Michel Ladilouya Christian Lusakweno Top Congo FM Général Raus Colonel Van. Jean Mukenge, André Kimbuta, Son Excellence Bongeli, Barnabé Kikaya, Ambassadeur Antoine Gonda, Sam Pengombei Leader, Didi Kinwani. Vera Mokolovina, go pesa Moulangi. Tatiti Gana, Olivier Bia, Hiro Leblanc, Issi Mwanga, Maïle Kina, Robin Gele, Elo Gata, Beauté Kamayenne, Hervé de Lille, la Chicote à papa, Commandant Watao, Amos Bienaou, être grand ne veut pas dire mesurer 3 mètres, GS Bogota. Loris la Congolaise, Lucie Assassa, Kwasa Christiana. Dido, Latama, Milko Sarkozy, Eric Kaboza, Container, Kingston. Hey, double fat way. Joli Mayala, Nico Bokonzi, Coco Malanga, Coco Rubenga, Brigitte Amba, et Bijou Bokonde la charmante. Tout le monde, vidéo ma solo 4, vidéo ma double.
Valérie Mankenda, Adi Londolé, Ali Nolé.
Live in London. Omer Menza, Beta Beta Fidel, Carlos Salum, Super Mec, Superstar, bienvenue qui sommeille, Coco Claudia, Sassou, Jean-Jacques Bayonne, Sam Pengombei, Liberia Presse, Grand Lac. Mukazi, na Toronto. Jean-Claude Wakube, Papa Zoom. Malu Chingila. Martin Zobi. Tabin Temo.
Nada! Buena! Buena! Dona Bona Boki!
Mama Weaver. Jean-Maya Kapongo. Emi Isalo.
Le propriétaire de tous les dossiers. Hey, 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 hey. Avec la participation de Jocelyne Berroa.
avec ma marita de Stuttgart. Kiki Touré.
Le propriétaire de tous les dossiers.
Crazy,
T-Rex. You make me crazy.
Crazy.
Yes, 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 that was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday Commentary. Tonight, we are unable to bring you regular commentator, Dr. Suleiman Nyang. Dr. Nyang, however, will be back next week. Instead, we take a look at Africa's economies. International economists are optimistic about Africa's economy. They say the continent will grow by up to 5 or 6% over the next 2 years, its best growth rate since the global economic recession in 2009. William Ego has this report.
Good news for Africa, say the experts. Growth is healthy and broad-based, fueled in part by infrastructure spending, domestic demand, and trade. Angela Lusigi is an economist and policy advisor for the Regional Bureau for Africa in the United Nations Development Program.
A lot of people, when they think about growth in Africa, they think it's only driven by mineral wealth or oil-exporting countries. But what we find in our report is that even those countries that are not considered resource-rich are still growing effectively. And this is mainly because of their agricultural sector, but also growth in services and a little bit of growth in manufacturing.
The report found that Africa's main foreign commercial partner is Europe, which accounted for nearly 40% of African trade, while 25% was with Asia and about 12% with North America. This year's African Economic Outlook notes that African countries traded $81 million worth of goods, among themselves in 2012, and that such trade is growing faster than the continent's exports to the rest of the world. In the decade ending in 2010, inter-African trade experienced over 13% annual growth. Much of that trade is in light manufacturing of such goods as textiles, clothing, leather, building material, farm implements, and wood products. Lusigi says there's also strong domestic demand for manufactured goods, including television sets, phones, and other mobile technology. She says many of these products can be made in Africa. According to the report, two regions, East and West Africa, are leading the economic expansion with over 6% growth. The report attributes growth in part to lower inflation, particularly in energy and food prices, and to prudent macroeconomic policies by African nations. They include efforts to reduce deficits by cutting spending or limiting its growth, and improving tax collection.
Well, I think one of the things that the report says, and the underlying macroeconomic framework is in place, and a lot of countries have balanced their budgets, they're not having unsustainable debt, they're managing the exchange rate, and right now a lot of countries are putting a lot of focus in borrowing to invest in infrastructure. And this is happening not just for oil exporting countries, but even countries that are not considered resource rich. So as far as the macroeconomic policies and frameworks goes, there's been a lot of change in the last couple of years, such that we now have a framework where, broadly speaking, a lot of countries are managing quite well. And the difference now, the next step is saying, how do we translate this stable macroeconomic framework into inclusive growth that touches the lives of people? Because one of the things that we are seeing is that there's a lot of inequality still. So as much as we're talking about growth, we have to see how that growth can impact all people and not just one group of people.
The report says external inflows of cash to Africa have remained stable or are growing. Official Development Assistance, ODA, estimated to be about $55 billion, remains an important lifeline for poor countries that lack sufficient foreign direct investment. Remittances from Africans abroad have remained healthy. They have rebounded since the economic downturn in 2009 and are expected to reach about $67 billion this year. Remittances are now the largest single external flow of funds to the continent and an important contributor to education and healthcare expenses. Following close behind revenues from remittances is foreign direct investment, currently at nearly $40 billion U.S. dollars. The report predicts that with sustained interest by investors in manufacturing and services, FDI could be more than $54 billion over the next 3 years. Henri Bernard Solignac-Lecomte is the head of the Africa desk at the OECD Development Center in Paris.
We also see a rise in greenfield FDI, you know, into some light manufacturing, some agro-processing, and also some market-sinking investment of people who are, for instance, putting together infrastructure for distribution. So you have, you know, the mass mart investing in Eastern Africa, for instance, which signal that investors increasingly recognize Africa not only as a repository of commodities, but also as a market.
The report says a decade of strong growth has reduced poverty in sub-Saharan Africa, with the number of people living on less than $1.25 per day falling from nearly 60% to just below 50%. Continued growth, it says, depends upon the ability of countries to participate in so-called global value chains, as South Africa has done with manufacturing car parts. It also depends on creating an environment that attracts investors and a workforce with the skills that contribute to global manufacturing. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of us here, the Nightline team, we thank you for sharing your Saturday with us. I'm Douglas Simpoga in Washington. Have a very wonderful evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Self-government, that is, a people exercising all the necessary functions of power without interference by a higher authority that they can't control themselves, is a core American value. It's also at the heart of the Declaration of Independence, which we celebrate today. Thomas Jefferson, the document's primary author, wrote that self-rule is the separate and equal station that a people are entitled to under the laws of God and nature. It didn't come easily. America's early history is marked by conflict with other countries threatened by Republican government and among Americans themselves over the ultimate form that that government would take. But the Declaration laid the framework for a nation that would endure and grow, inspiring similar independence movements around the world. When war first broke out between Britain and its North American colonists, few imagined, let alone supported, the creation of a new nation. Historians note that even as the fighting raged, the colonists were deeply divided over the future. Roughly a third came to believe a complete break with Britain was needed. A third remained loyal to the British crown, and a third simply wanted to be left alone to raise their families and do their jobs. The 56 men who signed the Declaration on July 4, 1776, cast the first votes for independence. Their fellow citizens ratified the choice, and with it the then radical principle that government should be based on the consent of the governed. While this is the event and cause we celebrate today, it isn't unique to Americans. It is embodied in the constitutions of many nations and observed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that we all recognize. In essence, then, Independence Day is a celebration of our common humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.